Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Offenbach's operetta, The Tales of Hoffmann, is a classic. It is the story of the poet Hoffmann, his quest to find true love, and his three ill-fated love affairs. In its full glory, the original lasts well over 3 hours, requires a couple dozen singers, and in true operatic fashion, various characters die after singing.
Well, it's safe to say that the version of the show about to open at the Skylight Music Theater isn't at all like that. Well, except for that dying after singing part. I met stage director Jill Anna Ponasek and translator and adapter Danny Brilo at the stage during a recent rehearsal to find out more.
Jill and I met probably about a year ago to kind of discuss what we were thinking for a new adaptation of the show. We knew we wanted it to be in English. We kept one piece in French, but mostly in English, and just kind of something that we could craft to our specific vision for the piece. We cut certain sections of it. There's a lengthy prologue in the original that we pretty much cut entirely and rewrote as a spoken scene to focus on the relationship between Hoffmann, the main character, and then Niklaus, his friend and muse. So from there, we kind of just sort of went to town in terms of figuring
we
out.
We thought about a lot of things.
Yeah.
There's a lot that went through a transformative process as we adapted it specifically for the Cabot stage and specifically for these two companies. So it's kind of a custom built adaptation.
So why did you need to adapt it initially? Did you wanted to first of all,
and then, it's when Ray Jivoff and I talked about the classical programming for this season, Tales of Hoffmann came up because it had been considered in the past, but it's a monumental work. It's got a full symphony orchestra and it's 3+ hours long and it's in French and it has a cast of 20 people. So we thought, well, the Skylight has this history of producing Offenbach. It was on the menu quite a lot in the 70s and 80s. And then there's a period without Jacques on the menu. And we thought, well, why haven't we done his best known work? Is there a way to craft it so that we can focus on our strengths and make it just for this audience? And so that sounded like an exciting problem to chew on.
I mean, the essential story is the same. Like you say, you've just changed some things around it to either streamline it or whatever. Obviously, I'm looking over your shoulders here at this amazing...
This is not the original orchestration.
No, it's not. There's a lot of glockenspiels and marimbas and other percussion. Now, is Ding going to be the only musician, or do you have other people?
Oh, nope. We have four. So it's two pianos, four hands, harp, and percussion. Okay. So it's a little band of four instrumentalists, but many instruments.
There must be 25 feet of percussion instruments back there.
That's probably modest.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's
and
amazing.
Some that we don't even play.
Right. They're just there, like old pianos and things like that. And I have to say, I think I walked in and said, oh, look, it's piano strings in the back.
Yeah, that was one of the ideas. Playing with scale, and also when you read the tales themselves, they're completely lathered with music at every turn. Musical metaphors, characters that play musical instruments that have supernatural powers. You know, there are so...
Don't they all?
Well, that's one of the questions that we ask. Like, how do you turn this violin into this magical thing that sounds so glorious? It's just a piece of wood, but it's not. Like, there's something
there's
that we do to it that makes it truly magic. And that's kind of the central idea of this production. So the bits and parts of the musical instruments are what we make the piece out of.
I also noticed in researching E.T.A. Hoffmann while working on the adaptation, he himself was very concerned with the role of the artist in society. He spent a lot of his life trying to convince the bourgeois in his culture of the importance of the arts, sort of the quintessential romantic era artist in that regard. And so a lot of his stories themselves, the hero of the story might be an artist, for example, and the stories themselves were adapted for a play, which then Offenbach adapted as well. And Hoffmann himself becomes the hero of those stories. So I kind of, in the set, see that reflected as well, the idea that the artist is central to the stories, and then we get all these cool, wonderful instruments materializing in the set.
A long, long time ago in a faraway court, there lived a jester of stature uncommonly short. He was forced to abort every quip and retort when his nose would deport a resound. sounding snort. His snort did thwart his standing at the court. To thwart his snort became his last resort. Each passing day he grew ever more distressed. That wily snort just couldn't be suppressed. At the king's behest, he attempted to wrest the nefarious pest from within his chest. The pest progressed, the king was not impressed. Depressed his quest, at last was lain to rest.
Well, this is a perfect time to say, what are the tales? I mean, for people who don't know this, who are not opera people, who don't know what this is about, what are the tales of Hoffmann?
There are three tales in the opera. One is the tale of Olympia, in which the hero falls in love with a mechanical doll and is thus disappointed. It's a cautionary tale for all of us. Yeah. There's the tale of Antonia, where our hero falls in love with a girl who has a mysterious illness whereby she will die if she sings. And she loves to sing, so she dies. So another tale of caution for us all. And then in the third tale, the tale of Giulietta, he falls in love with a courtesan who steals his reflection in exchange for a diamond. So another routine,
cautionary
everyday
tale.
Story.
Yes. Yes.
No metaphors.
None.
Present.
No, it's
whatsoever.
It's completely
straightforward. It's all just straightforward and very realistic.
Yeah. Yeah, I can tell. And people will think this is why I don't go to opera, because I can't understand any of it.
It makes a lot of weird sense. And so we embarked on this project where we spent an entire semester working with the students at UWM last year studying Tales of Hoffmann, and that was part of our adaptive process for this production. And one of the things that the entire class of students like latched onto immediately was the supernatural aspect of the tales and sort of the legacy of macabre artists from Stephen King to Edward Gorey to the supernatural show to the Twilight Zone, but like all of those different aspects that are exploring the real and the unreal juxtaposed.
Yeah, and how they overlap.
And it makes perfect sense to people. I mean, that's what's funny is we talk about these absurd stories, but they belong in the culture in this specific genre.
Do you think Hoffmann was sort of a progenitor of those things?
Yeah, he's largely believed to be like at the beginning of developing the fantasy genre. You know, so preceding Edgar Allan Poe and Telltale Heart and...
And Poe was pretty early when you think about it, 1840s.
Yep.
1830s, 1840s, so...
This is like 1817, right? Or the first edition, 17 or 19?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Mm-hmm. Hoffmann was born in 1776, so he was, preceded Poe by just a little bit. But definitely, I would agree, the progenitor of that kind of genre that we are definitely used to today in TV and other, mm-hmm. various media.
Well, and there's usually some sort of, as you say, cautionary piece to
well,
that.
Well, they are all these metaphors for addiction, obsession, even for Antonia, the like what you love, what you want more than anything in the world is to sing, but you can't or you'll die, but you can't resist it, so you do,
and
then
you die.
Yeah.
Right. And see, we told you,
and
it was
like,
going to happen.
Did you not know that was coming?
Yeah.
Actually, in this case, it's a great like Me Too moment story because no one tells her. The men in the story all know that she has this mysterious illness, but no one bothers to alert her. They just tell her not to sing.
So they don't tell her why.
They do not tell her why.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So there's another kind of... like, well, as you sit with it for a while, you're like,
interesting.
No,
don't. And, it's funny how works like this that have been in the canon for so long, and then you start seeing them in new ways because things change around
us. Them. Yes,
yeah.
Hugely. And Olympia the doll, what does that mean to fabricate a life-sized woman and imbue her with life or
it's kind of a Blade
the appearance
Runner thing.
Of, yep, like that's what is the ideal love interest,
right.
And can we build her? Which we definitely do in lots of different ways.
Oh, child of the sun, let me ascend into her shimmering eyes' reflection, and grant me but one moment to spend, bathed in the beauty of perfection. Come, open thy gate, let me ascend, let me ascend, open thy gate, let me ascend.
He's been hooked.
To be out of her sight is pure anguish. I must see her again.
Oh, her head.
Oh, I shudder to think.
She's divine.
What's in store?
Always by her side, I'd be content to languish. Oh, child of the sun, let me ascend into her shimmering eyes' reflection, and grant me but one moment to spend, bathed in the beauty of perfection. Come, open thy gate, let me ascend.
Sorry, I keep looking past you, and I'm just enjoying the view of the instruments and the ropes that are the backdrop of the piano strings, and it's quite something. So
that was part of the choice to reorchestrate it in this way, was looking at the resources that are available. Mm-hmm. So you have like Ding here as an asset in the organization and the imagination of Carrie Hart, our music director, but by reducing it this way, we cast sopranos in baritone roles. It's part of the way that the cycle that you move through the three stories, but that meant being able to alter a key if necessary to work things out. And by making the orchestra more nimble, it gave us the flexibility, by focusing on pianos particularly, to adjust as necessary in the rehearsal process. And it's worked really smoothly. And then because of Ding's percussion collection, we leave behind the particular sound of a symphony orchestra, but we gain this really otherworldly, eerie quality that is its own thing, you know? So rather than experiencing a sense of loss, we're trying to embrace, like, oh, what are these other interesting things that this stuff can do?
Right, well, you know? I never think of any of your productions as losing anything. It's always just a different take. It's a different way of approaching the material. So it's like, okay, yeah, well, if you're expecting, you know, the full symphony and, you know, like a Met production, this isn't it.
No, nope.
Yeah.
It's not that. Come for something else.
Yeah, but that's okay. It doesn't have to be that.
Come for a deeply intriguing story, phenomenally radiant performances, and really quirky instrumentalization. But we, like, really specifically, they're on stage for a very important reason, that they're really part of it, that we get to watch them. The harpist is up on the platform. Like, we get to watch them, their technique, watch them playing, watch them interpreting it.
Did you do the orchestration of this or not?
No, actually, our music director, Carrie Hart, was the one who did that kind of in conjunction, I guess, as I was completing the translation. She was working on the orchestration.
It was like it kind of was a bit stick. He was out in the lead, and then as he was generating material.
Yeah. Yeah, like a lot of times I would write something, and then I wrote a line about the harp in there, and it was during a section of spoken dialogue, and Carrie said, let's add a little harp glissando there, you know? So it's kind of bouncing off each other, you know?
Are you happy with the way it came out?
I am. It was...
It's a scary question to ask, Bonnie.
No, I am. It is probably a bigger project than I've ever attempted before. I had done a couple other adaptations in the past, and this one, we did cut a lot of material, but it, you know, even with that, it's a lot more singing, I think, than we had done in the past. Magic Flute we did, and that is a Singspiel, so it has a lot of spoken dialogue. This has spoken dialogue too, but for some reason, this just was such a bigger undertaking, it felt like. But in the end, yeah, I'm pretty happy with what came out.
It's a big sing with big, bold ensembles. And those are not easy to get from French into English, which are not necessarily two languages that like being married anyway. It's really exciting.
Jill Anaponicek directs the Skylight Milwaukee Opera Theater co-production of Offenbach's The Tales of Hoffman. Danny Brilo did the new adaptation and translation.
We heard singers John Kanakletis, Cecilia Davis, Diane Lane, and Ariana Douglas. We also heard pianist Josh Robinson along with percussionist Michael Lawrence.
The show opens this Friday at the Broadway Theater Center in the Third Ward. There is more information at WUWM.com.